Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 7th of August. Coming up on the program, the impact of Total Energy's departure from gas exploration off the southern African coast. Why race rioting has erupted across the United Kingdom. Is government playing a water woes blame game? And the crisis of youth depression in South Africa. I want to start with gas exploration, and is this a body blow for the sector? HCI Chief Executive Officer Johnny Copeland thinks so. He's told group shareholders that the withdrawal of the French energy major Total Energies from gas field projects in South Africa, in his words, a disaster for the development of the bloc. HCI has exposure to the field off the Southern Cape Coast through its shareholding in Canada-based Africa Energy Corporation. Analysis now from Dr. Lumkile Monde, School of Economics and Finance at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg. And Dr. Monde, first of all, how do you see this move?
So firstly, it's important for us to understand that Johnny Copeland is a huge investor in the sector. I think many South Africans remember that he and others were bidding for the Wild Coast resources to participate in the development of the fossil fuels in that area. So a total withdrawal should be understood within the context of the very disincentivizing regulatory problem that South Africa faces, where the Department of Mineral Resources and Petroleum has been dismal in creating an environment which supports long-term investment in that sector. And therefore, Total and many others who are exiting South Africa going to areas which are friendly regulatory-wise shouldn't surprise us at all. We need a government that can create those incentives for people to invest long-term. Without that environment, I think we're going to see more firms exiting.
Dr. Monde, what exactly is wrong, in your opinion, with the regulatory environment, and how does it need to be eased up?
So the main thing relates to title. I remember the exploitation of deep sea fossil resources requires huge investment upfront in exploration. And therefore, those that take that risk need to be rewarded accordingly based on the risk that they've taken. In South Africa, there's a huge focus on state as well as BEE being participant to that. And in that regard, therefore, the rules not being transparent, it ensures that many players would like to plow in billions of rands and then find themselves that they're caught up with the state wanting a bigger share, as well as BEE players wanting a bigger share without taking the initial risk that is taken by them. So that's the problem. So create an environment that empowers the short-term and the medium-term risk on exploration and allow them to then exploit and benefit, because there are other ways of ensuring that those type of risk benefit South Africans through royalties and other forms that you see in other jurisdictions such as Namibia.
And Dr. Monde, do you think there are any indications that government might do that?
I think the government is going to do it when companies like Total and many others exit. I think there's going to be a point whereby they start moving because there's no investment taking place and therefore desperately change the rules. But it'll be too late, because I think the other countries have got better resources and a better environment. So it's a huge opportunity cost for South Africa.
So how might this withdrawal or delay in developing additional exploration assets affect the country's energy security and transition plans? How big a setback is this?
The setback is enormous, Jeremy. So what I'll do if for South Africa, given the proximity of both Namibia and Mozambique, I will piggyback on forging relationships and having a much better supply arrangement, both on the fuel side as well as on the electricity side, because we know that Namibia can power many of us, their neighbors, Angola, DRC and South Africa. But similarly, on the eastern side, the Mozambican resource can do likewise. So we do have guys that are already ahead with Total, Shell, as well as Eni, including Americans, in fact, on the Mozambican side, being already far ahead. I think if we put more resources and effort in that and then delay these others, because as we exhaust those other resources in Namibia and Mozambique, there could be further opportunities from rents that will be created by these companies to in about 50, 60 years to then go and exploit the South African resources, which will be there anyway. They're not going to go away.
Do you think the likes of Total could be convinced to come back?
The likes of Total will be convinced to come back, unless, of course, South Africa is playing geopolitics by thinking about possibilities of relationship with the Chinese, the Iranians, and the Russians, whom we know also have got capability around the exploitation of such resources. So it may as well be an ANC-led action in influencing GNU to delay, because their friends in the BRICS, including Iran, they are ready to come and work with South Africans to exploit those resources. That's all. I'm just speculating, but we shouldn't forget that we've got a past around the nuclear program, which Zuma, as the president, had tried to sneak in without due processes.
And Dr. Mondi, a final question to you. This particular issue, I would imagine, is also a bigger metaphor for regulatory overreach in South Africa, is it not?
Absolutely. I mean, it's playing itself in this petroleum sector, but it's a much broader a challenge for South Africa, whether it's the water sector and other sectors, where we see regulatory constraints hampering investment and therefore creating a huge incentive for growth and development of South Africa in an environment of increasing levels of poverty and unemployment. And you wonder, what are these regulators and political players thinking when they are punishing their own consequences in a very difficult global environment?
Dr. Lumkele Monde, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the pictures have been nothing short of horrific. Towns and cities around the United Kingdom have been shaken after a week of rioting, ostensibly fueled by online misinformation and extremist views. All of this follows a deadly knife attack in the town of Southport. More now from Jeff Hill, who reports for the Washington Times and also the Spectator magazine. Jeff, a very warm welcome. And is there a single reason for this?
No, there isn't. Much like riots that have taken place in South Africa or in Kenya, it's a build-up of pressure over years that finally found some outlet, and people point to that, to the trigger, and say that was the cause, but it wasn't. It was simply the straw that broke the camel's back.
And Jeff, this is driven largely by misinformation online. How has that manifested itself? And perhaps more specifically, who's responsible?
So it started with a guy called Axel Rudakubana, who was 18. He's 18 today. It's his birthday today on Wednesday. 18-year-old Rwandan, born in Cardiff in Wales, of immigrant Rwandan parents. And for no reason, this very quiet youth went on a stabbing spree and murdered three girls and left several other people in hospital. And that's what started the riots about there are too many immigrants arriving in small boats landing on the coast of the UK. There are thousands coming in every year this way from France, leaving France and arriving in the UK. And neither side of politics has been able to stop them. and this has become obviously a major cause. Not within the right, it's wrong to say within the right, it's become a cause within the British working class.
And sadly, many innocent people at this point are feeling threatened and in many respects almost under siege.
Yes, they are. So one must remember that 4% of the British population is black or of mixed race, and 15%, 1/5, of the British prison population is black. So there is this feeling that, you see, blacks are causing a lot of trouble. But the flip side of that is that the majority of black British people go about their lives peacefully and contribute greatly to the UK and to its communities and its economy.
And Jeff Hill, law enforcement agencies, how are they addressing twin challenges, one managing the riots, but also tackling this tsunami of misinformation?
Well, the misinformation has very quickly been stomped on and corrected, but that wasn't, Jeremy, the cause of the outbreak. It wasn't the cause of the riot, as I said. It was this build-up over a long time. Let me give you an example. Around 5% of all house breakings, where people come into your house and take your TV or whatever, around 5% of all house breakings in the UK end in an arrest. 95% do not. So there's this feeling that crime is is out of control. And who are the people who get broken into? Look at Joburg. It's the people in Tembisa and Dipsluit. It's not the people in Sandton. And the same thing here. It's working class people in the poorer communities who feel that the government is not listening to them. So it's a whole range of issues like that that have led to this final breakout of rioting sparked by the death of these girls.
And Jeff Hill, a new government, it's putting it under a lot of pressure. What specifically is the new Prime Minister Keir Starmer saying, and are there specific new actions that are being considered or implemented to prevent future incidents like this?
Jeremy, he's in a way made it worse. Among the target community, when I say the target community, the people that he's trying to quieten down and stop them rioting, he says that there will be no mercy, that they are all going to prison if the courts say so. At the courts, he's asked to work 24 hours a day, so judges are sitting round the clock. And of course, these people who rioted said, well, hang on, during the Black Lives Matter riots or during the Muslim marches complaining against Islamophobia, the police took a quiet line. The police stepped back, cars were turned over and burnt and buildings set on fire, but nothing or very little was done. But when white people go on the rampage, then the government wants to clamp down. Now, that's not necessarily true, but Keir Starmer's comments are playing to the prejudice within the community that's gone rioting. That can't help.
And Jeff, these are riots that are not confined just to major cities in the United Kingdom. It's spread far and wide.
It is. So the stabbing by this Rwandan youth took place in Southport, which is about 300 kilometers northwest of London, on the coast facing Ireland. But these riots have been in Birmingham, they've been on the Scottish border, they've been in London, in the southwest, southeast. Yes, there have been in communities right across the country, and it seems that there's a lot of discontent. And more than anything else, Jeremy, a lot of people who feel the government is not listening or not hearing their pain. And I do see similarities to this if I go to a beer hall in Johannesburg or around Durban, and I listen to young black people who are out of work. It's not just being out of work. They say nobody listens. And I see the same thing here.
Jeff Hill, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let me return the program home now. And Water and Sanitation Minister Pemi Majudina says the country's water boards, responsible for providing and maintaining water infrastructure, are owed something in the region of 21 billion rand by municipalities, and she says are threatening the viability of the sector. So let's get some expert comment now from water scientist Professor Anthony Turton. And first of all, Professor, why have these municipalities accumulated such a large debt?
I think the The reason why this has happened has been a failure of the regulatory authority over the last two decades. You have a regulator in the form of the Department of Water Affairs, as it used to be called, now called Water and Sanitation, and they are supposed to act as regulator. But there's a constitutional problem, and that constitutional problem is in the cooperative governance clause that says that one government department cannot interfere in the activities of another arm of government. So the reason why you've had this cumulative debt now, as far as I'm concerned, is nothing more than a manifestation of this absolutely ridiculous constitutional requirement. We need an independent regulator, because if we had an independent regulator, then 20 years ago, this problem would have been nipped in the bud and it would not have been allowed to accumulate as it has.
Professor, do you think the new minister then is correct when she says that the financial viability of the entire sector is now under threat as a result of this debt?
Insider professionals have known this for at least a decade, that the whole water sector is not sustainable as it currently is. In fact, it's very dire, because we've been talking for some time now about the fact that we need at least 1 trillion rand just to refinance the water sector, just to get what's broken fixed up again. But of course, that ignores the fact that your municipalities have also been losing a major revenue stream from unaccounted for water. All the water lost in the system that's either not billed or lost to leaks, etc. That unaccounted for water has also resulted in an amplified unaccounted for revenue stream. Because remember, municipalities are retailers of water. They buy water wholesale from the bulk water providers, the water boards, and they then put a markup onto it. So for every drop of unaccounted for water, that is a significant loss of revenue to the municipalities.
Professor, apart from the regulatory issue that you've just raised, is there anything else that national government can do to address the financial instability of these boards?
Well, I must commend the current leadership in the Department of Water and Sanitation. They really are coming to the party. And I don't envy the current minister her task. It's a pity that the previous minister was moved out, because he was doing a very good job. But indications are that the executive team has been left pretty much intact. And that's a good news story. So even no matter what the minister is or who the minister is, I think with the current executive team, we're in very good hands. And I think the same is starting to happen now in the different water boards. We're starting to see like a bifurcation. Some of the bad water boards are unable to self-correct, and they are going to slowly go down the tubes and fail. But some of the better managed ones have realized that there's a very serious crisis, and they're starting to turn that around. And Rand Water is in the latter. Rand Water is very, very much aware of the fact that their financial viability is at stake, and they are really coming to the party to try and make a difference.
So what specifically are these entities doing to turn things around?
Well, I think firstly, it's like when you're an alcoholic, when you recognize that you're an alcoholic and you admit it, and then you start realizing that you've got to do something differently. The same with financial mismanagement. You have to recognize the fact that your institutions are failing. And only once you recognize that, if you continue to deny it and deflect blame onto other parties, then you're not accepting responsibility for it. So I've seen this turnaround now in the last couple of months, where places like Rand Water have started to say, we have a problem, we need to do something internally. But of course, Rand Water is stuck in the middle, or the water boards in general are stuck in the middle, because it's the delinquent municipalities that are unable or unwilling to pay. So we're really seeing a domino knock-on effect here. It's actually municipal insolvency that's now impacting on the service providers, the wholesale providers of the services. They are under pressure, and each of them gets different revenue streams. The municipalities get funding from government to subsidize water, but the water boards don't get that. They have to raise capital on the open markets, and they also have to get their money from their end users. So the water boards are stuck in the middle, and unfortunately, if the water boards fail, then we have a serious crisis in South Africa, because the entire economy is geared up around the fact that your bulk water provided comes from the National Department of Water and sanitation. The waterborne are wholly owned, state-owned enterprises owned by the national department. And then, of course, they supply onto the municipalities, which are now independent. So the whole supply chain is geared up around that assumption. And if any of the water boards start to fail, then you start seeing a ripple effect throughout the economy.
So let's go to the bottom of the pyramid then. How can municipalities be held more accountable for their failure to pay the water boards? And are there mechanisms, Professor Turton, that could be put in place to prevent future debt accumulation?
Well, I think that is an extremely important question, and I wish I had the answer to it. I understand the reason why it's happened, and let's call it for what it is. The policy of cadre deployment has allowed people that are technically incompetent but loyal to a particular party, that's allowed those people to be put into executive positions where they've had to make decisions that have accumulated over decades and have now ended up in what we have. So until such time as you start holding those executive decision makers accountable for their actions, you're not going to turn it around. And that implies, therefore, that there has to be the political will where an executive decision maker, a member of the executive team of any municipality or metro, where they make decisions that ultimately lead to delinquency, they have to be held accountable. I don't see any political will at this point in time to make that happen.
Professor Anthony Turton, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Forecasting Green Jobs in Africa, a first-of-its-kind report predicting the creation of up to 3.5 million new direct green jobs across the continent by 2030, with the majority in the renewable energy sector, and particularly solar. More now from Kiara Remescheid, Director, Shortlist Futures, one of the companies behind the study. A warm welcome to you. So why then is the solar sector in pole position?
Sure. I think solar is great for four main reasons. The first is that it's universally accessible, right? Africa is full of sun. It's available most of the year, and it's really quick to deploy. So compared to other, infrastructure projects, the time that it takes to actually build a solar site, whether it be, a distributed renewable energy type of investment or a utility scale, it's very fast to deploy. The second is that solar is generating sizable amounts of jobs, both in that DRE space as well as in the utility scale generation. And so that's in DRE, that's mainly because there's a high number of jobs created per gigawatt, as there is for utility scale as well. And I think lastly, the thing that's great about solar is that 30% of these jobs are specialized. And so as we think about what that means in terms of job creation, right, going forward, this means that folks are going to be getting jobs that are of high quality, that are commanding high incomes, and that are going to put them on track for long-term career growth.
And there's also a domino effect, isn't there? The quicker the take-up is, particularly solar, the better impact it's going to have on broad continental economic growth.
Yes, of course. I mean, I think particularly in the case of South Africa, right, where Eskom is not maybe doing as well as it needs to be, having these backup systems or these alternative systems that are going to allow, right, businesses to stay, to invest in scaling up their production and in creating more jobs really will kind of have this leapfrog development effect, we hope, to generating broad growth for individuals, their communities, and countries at large.
So how difficult, Kiara, is it going to be, do you think, to meet the demand for skilled green jobs in or across the continent? Are we moving apace in this respect?
Yeah, so I think the short answer to that is not exactly. I think, as we kind of look at what the breakdown is of these jobs, what the report really teases out is that 40% of these jobs will be, they'll require no skills. So essentially someone without even formal education, high school education, college education, will be able to take those on. And that's an amazing, boon for those folks, right, who are looking to find job opportunities. Where it does get a bit trickier is for that remaining 60%, which does require more specialized skill. And I think the huge reason we wanted to do this work, why BCG took part in it, why FSDA took part in it, was because we wanted to be able to start to do talent pipelining, to be able to say, if over the next 6 years we know that there's 275 new solar jobs in South Africa, what does that actually mean against their current workforce? And how can we start to work with, government, the private sector, NGOs, whoever that might be, you know, in consortium to get that skill within these populations so that as these projects do come online, folks are going to be in line and ready to take up those roles. Because without it, you know, we risk some of these projects not coming to fruition or reaching their full potential, which would dampen these potentials for green growth.
You talk about talent pipelining. Are there specific strategies then that are recommended to address that skills gap in the green job ecosystem and how to accelerate development in that respect?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's different ways to think about this. One way to think about this is just in terms of gender equity within the workforce. So we know that women are far less represented in the renewable energy space globally and on the continent. And so, for example, we have a initiative right now with a company called Nuru in the DRC, which is operating and building mini grids to last mile communities who don't currently have access. They really want to bring on women into this workforce as solar installers, as maintenance keepers, et cetera, because they're not currently represented. And so what we've been doing with them, because they have, you know, a clear line of sight on what their growth trajectory looks like, is going out there, identifying, you know, high potential women who can take on these roles, developing specific trainings that they have these skills so that as then, you know, Nuru's breaking ground in Goma versus, you know, Kinshasa or wherever it might be, there are women who are ready to be deployed to take on those skills. So you can think about it company by company, which is sort of where we have been. But what's exciting, I think, about this report and what this data now tells us is we now have a clear idea of where these new jobs will be. And now the next step will be to look at and do talent gap analysis to understand, okay, if we know these jobs will be here in the next 6 years, where's the current workforce in whatever we about and what skills now do we know that we need to start to be giving them again through those cross-sectoral partnerships to ensure that these folks will be ready to take on these jobs.
Do you think there is universal acceptance of the concept, or do you think there is still a degree of skepticism which might prevent government and private sector from better and more efficient collaboration?
I think it's always going to be a bit tricky to bridge that gap between government and the private sector. I think in this case, though, there are really strong incentives for these two groups of stakeholders to work together, right? Governments desperately need to accelerate job creation. You know, so much of the continent's population currently doesn't have access to jobs. They need that to be able to secure growth. And these companies need enabling environments from the governments to be able, right, to grow and to scale at the pace and clip that we're all hoping to see to be able to realize, right, this green growth potential. So there's probably some differences between the two, but they really do share, I think, a lot in common when it comes to wanting to achieve, you know, these mutual goals and outcomes.
Well, 3.3 million new direct green jobs is an impressive number. Kiara Remescheid, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on the program today, do we have a youth depression problem in South Africa? Little research, I'm told, has been done on depression and anxiety among younger adolescents. Talking to me now is Roshni Parbu-Sita, Project Manager, Education South African Depression and Anxiety Group. Roshni, welcome and thank you very much indeed. That 10 to 14-year-old cohort, why has it been neglected?
So I think, Jeremy, thank you so much, firstly, for having me. I think the problem is that not a lot of money gets spent on mental health research. And so we don't often get to find out what's happening in the schools and what's happening with our youngsters specifically and why they are struggling so much. And so thanks to this research that has been done, it hasn't been done by the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, but we welcome the research because it gives us so much insight into what's happening with the youngsters and why they are struggling so much.
Well, explain to me why they are struggling then and how it manifests itself.
So, I mean, SADC themselves have gone into so many schools in Gauteng specifically, with the Gauteng Department of Education. And what we are finding is suicide itself is such a complex issue, and there's so many reasons why kids are taking their lives. Reasons like financial stresses, reasons like bullying, you know, things like family issues. You know, one child may come to school and might have issues with a friendship circle and then also have issues with academics and then still go home and have problems with mom, dad, and siblings. And so there's so much that goes on in a youngster's life that we don't understand. There isn't just one thing that is going wrong. And so there's so many different complexities that are going on with these youngsters that we just don't get, because we seem to think that life is so easy for them, because we're looking at it from an adult's perspective.
Is there then a different way of dealing with depression among this age group?
Absolutely. I think number one, we need to realize that depression is an illness, and we need to open up those lines of communication. We need to understand that we have to talk to our youngsters about depression. We have to talk to them about things that are worrying them and help them communicate about things that may be worrying them, things that they may not understand. So for youngsters, they see a problem and their first thought is, I'm going to take my life. I don't know how to sort this out. It seems very overwhelming for them. And so opening up those lines of communication helps. But what's happening with these youngsters is they don't feel like they can speak to us. They don't know who to talk to. Often they go to school and they may not have someone that they can speak to there, or they have only one person that they can speak to. They go home and they have no one that they can speak to there. So opening those lines of communication to say, I can see that you are struggling, trying to look at the signs and symptoms. This child used to love playing soccer, for example. They no longer enjoy doing that. Why aren't you doing that anymore? So we need to be able to speak to them about that. We need to be able to say to them, if you are feeling this way, there is someone that you can speak to. And so that's why the South African Depression and Anxiety Group goes out into schools and speaks to high school students about things like depression and mental health and suicide prevention.
And is medication a solution at that age?
Absolutely. So when it comes to mental health, there are so many different things that we can do in terms of getting them help. Medication is one of them. Therapy is another one. But there's so many other things that we can do to get them help. There is support systems. There is talking about it. There is just simple things like taking a walk, right? Writing a journal. But we need to be able to talk about it and figure that out together. And so developing that support system is so imperative.
Well, I'm glad we've been able to raise the issue on this program. Roshni Parbusita, Project Manager at SADAG, thank you very much for joining me today. And just before I say goodbye to you, on our last online poll, I asked this question: do local companies act with a consumer mindset? Yes, no, or I'm constantly disappointed. And the majority of our respondents saying business is failing them. Today, and this relates to our lead story, the gas exploration departure of Total Energies. Do you think the sector has now been compromised? Could this all have been avoided? Or do you think that energy security is now threatened? If you have a view on that, you can share it on our X or LinkedIn pages. And that's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.